You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
As is the custom in most Unitarian gatherings, our candle is lit as a symbol of the light that connects us all. Let it be a focus for our time together as we seek to find answers to those questions that will assist us on our spiritual journey. Good morning and welcome to our service of worship. It's called a service because it is meant to serve you. And it is worship because it raises to worth things that matter. My name is Bob Brummett, as all of you know, and I am not the minister, of course. I am one of those who are filling in while we do not have a minister since Rob McPherson departed to take this new appointment at Pembroke with our very best wishes. I welcome you on behalf of the generations of Unitarian Universalists who have worshipped in similar gatherings in South Australia since 1854. No matter who you are, you will find in this a community that supports you in finding, fashioning and following your own spiritual path. Whatever path helps you to see more clearly, love more abundantly and work towards a better world to all people. Please join us after the service for conversation. Now, the next item is the story for all ages. And we don't have any children, but I will still do the children story as if there were children and knowing that you're all children at heart. I think Mother's Day may have had something to do with the lack of children. And when I must warn you that my service I was not aware of it being Mother's Day until a week or so ago, because I couldn't really change anything. And my service has got nothing to do, specifically to do with children. Anyway, here's the story for all ages. It's about a man called Joseph Priestley, who lived in the latter part of the 18th century and was a Unitarian minister, who had a scientific bent as well and was very curious about the way the world works and was one of the first people who started to do experiments to see how things really worked instead of just dreaming up ideas. And one of his experiments was to see how long mice could survive on just living on cheese, biscuits and water with nothing else. He constructed a suitable cage for this to occur in. And here is a replica of it. There we are. This cage would actually be glass, no holes in it, except the hole at the top that could be filled in, and a tray at the bottom. And in this bell was cheese, biscuits, water, and a suitable bed for the mice at night. Every modern con, as far as the mice was concerned. And Priestley took the top off, put the two mice in, put the top back on again, and waited to see what happened. And what happened was, later during the day, the mice were running around happily, chewing away on the cheese and biscuits. But towards the evening, he looked in again and saw they were looking a bit sort of drowsy, but he thought this was probably because they'd just been overeating or something. So he went to bed himself, woke up in the morning, went back to the cage, and to his surprise, the mice were dead. So he wondered what had happened. He thought maybe there was something wrong with the cheese or the biscuits. So he replaced them, repeated the experiment, but got exactly the same result. So he wondered what had happened. He thought that perhaps it was that they didn't have some extra little bit of food. They needed some, what, vitamins, of course, hadn't been heard of for another 100 years, but he thought perhaps that was it. So he put in some vegetation to give the mice an opportunity to chew on something else. And the vegetation that he chose was mint, same as your mother makes mint sauce out of. And he put that in there as well. And then, he, having got it in, he then took to put two more mice in. And the mice ran around happily as before, chewing away on the cheese and the biscuits and drinking the water. And he looked in that night and they still seemed very happy. And he looked in the next morning and they were still just as happy as ever. And that went on for days. The mice survived perfectly well. But the remarkable thing was that he noticed that the mice did not take the slightest interest in the mint. They didn't care whether the mint was there or not. They certainly didn't eat any of it. So that made him think again, and that started him on the idea that it must be something to do with the fact that this was all airtight and the mice were just breathing the same air all the time. He didn't quite work out what the solution to the problem was, but other people helped him, and between the lot of them, they very quickly worked out that the problem had been that the mice were breathing in the air, and every time they breathed, they'd use up a bit of oxygen, which is one of the components of air, and convert it into gas called carbon dioxide, which is invisible and just floats around in the air too. And once the mice had used up nearly all the oxygen, they'd die. But they worked out that the mint, like every other plant or tree, does the opposite. It converts the carbon dioxide back into oxygen. So they were in balance, and the mice lived on for quite a long time until the balance got a bit upset one way or the other. The carbon dioxide doesn't do any harm. It's the lack of oxygen that kills them. Anyway, that experiment was historic for two things. First of all, it showed that the value of experiments. To make scientific discoveries, you have to do something that can get a result that can be repeated by other people doing the same thing. And this, of course, happened with this experiment all over the place. And the second important thing is that it is so important for very present day, we've got to get it right about having plenty of oxygen in the air and not too much carbon dioxide. And so we need lots and lots of trees. And it is society, it's a problem that your generation are going to have to cope with. There are probably too many people in the world and they drive too many cars and aeroplanes and engines and machines of all sorts. They all use up oxygen and trees are being chopped down to make grow more food, etc. We need more trees, far more trees. It's a problem that's got to be looked at in the future, but that's how it all started. Thank you. In about the mid-1970s, when I'd been a member of this church for several years, the then minister, Alan Kirby, sought volunteers who might take services to give him a bit of relief. Very understandable. Alan Kirby is here today, as you've no doubt noticed. He suggested as a suitable subject for these various volunteers, why I am a Unitarian. I did take up his invitation, but for some reason I did not choose that subject, but chose another, I can't remember what now. I've since given a dozen or more services, but never on that exact subject. So here goes, in about the 50th year of my membership of the church. I've actually been a Unitarian, though I didn't fully realise it, until I was about 11. No one had deliberately or directly influenced me. I came to the conclusion myself. I simply could not accept standard Christian/Anglican dogma even then, and I declined the fairly firm offer to join the rest of the class in being confirmed. That's how things stayed for the next 60 years or so. However, in the last 20 years or so, during which years I've had more time to indulge my mild to moderate interest in history, both world history and religious history, the views of my childhood have been even more strongly confirmed. I thought it might be of mild interest to explain how all this had come about, even if it means that they think they have come to a talk by an amateur historian rather than an amateur theologian. I'm sure that many details will be disagreed with by many of you, possibly major details. But I will ask you to try not to be too worried by this, but just to contemplate the overall points on them as they form the general background to why I am a Unitarian. Religions around the world were obviously fairly basic, worship of nature, local tribal rules, etc., until about 2,000 years BC, 4,000 years ago. The first organised religion, probably coinciding with the advent of writing, began about 4,000 years ago, and this was the religion developed by the descendants of the ancient Hebrew people, namely the Jews. This religion began with a shepherd named Abraham, who apparently had visions from God, the one and only God. It was a monotheistic religion. This caused him to leave his homeland of Mesopotamia, now Iraq, and move to Canaan, later called Palestine, and now Israel. On account of famine in Canaan, he moved to Egypt, where they lived happily for a few centuries, until an Egyptian pharaoh enslaved them. But a descendant of Abraham, called Moses, somehow rescued them, led them out of Egypt back to Canaan, possibly parting the Red Sea in the process, where he established the city of Jerusalem. However, disunity and conquest by various barbarians have sent Jews over the many centuries to all parts of the civilized world, where they have become significant, often very significant, but often persecuted minorities ever since. They continue to regard Jerusalem as their spiritual home, as of course do the Jews. While all this had been going on, but especially in the 500 years or so before the birth of Jesus, plenty else had been going on too, both as far as the world in general was concerned and with regard to religion. First, with regard to religion, no fewer than three new major religions had started. They were in order: Hinduism, which began in India about 1500 BC and remains the principal religion of India, even though the caste system, originally an important part of it, is now less important than it was. The official belief in reincarnation remains. Buddhism started also in India in about 500 BC, later than Hinduism. In fact, it was apparently up to a development from one of the numerous offshoots of Hinduism. Buddhism spread to become the major religion in most of Asia. The two religions were similar to the extent that they were both polytheistic, as opposed to the monotheistic Jewish religion, and both religions believed in some sort of eternal life through reincarnation. your status in the next life being dependent to some extent on your worthiness in the previous one. Unlike Hinduism, which had no particular human associated with it, Buddhism did have one, Gautama the Buddha. Confucius started the remaining major religion of the era. Strictly speaking, Confucianism is not a religion at all. There are no clergy, no god or gods, and no suggestion of life after death. It is more a guide to morality. Confucian was Chinese, and Confucianism has existed mainly in China, where it has fluctuated in popularity for the last 2,500 years. The fluctuations being due partly because people at different times have wanted their religion to offer some sort of eternal life and some sort of explanation for sorrow, etc., and partly because at different times some Chinese governments have not been keen on it when the Confucian idea of morality conflicted with their own. These three religions strike me as being relatively unaggressive towards themselves and each other. So much for the religions of those 2,000 years or so BC. Now for a brief consideration of the three great empires which occupied different but significant overlapping segments of the same time frame. First the ancient Egyptian Empire, then the ancient Greek Empire, and finally the ancient Roman Empire. Each of these empires had a language that obviously worked for them and would have been an important factor in their successes, as well as providing classical literature for scholars to wonder at 2,000 or more years later. Reasonable law and order was also achieved, a good knowledge of basic mathematics, and quite remarkable ability to build remarkable buildings which still amaze modern people 2,000, 3,000, or 4,000 years later. In addition, the Egyptians showed very early on how to utilize the miraculous annual flooding of the Nile to enable them to grow plenty of food. The Greeks introduced a version of democracy to the world, and the Romans, once they had conquered the Greeks a couple of centuries BC, because they seemed to be rivals, and the Egyptians round about the time of Jesus, mainly it seems because they were jealous of their ability to grow food. Once they'd achieved this and spread westward through France and then to parts of Britain, were able to rule this vast empire in a remarkably efficient and probably mutually beneficial way. Another interesting feature of it seems to me, of all these three empires was that in none of them had religion advanced at the same rate as everything else. Their religions were complex, polytheistic, and probably not as important in their lives as might have been expected. This was until the followers of Jesus, after his death, spread Christianity slowly but steadily until 200 or 300 years later, the Roman Empire became officially Christian. At about this time, the very large and complex and apparently well and efficiently run ancient Roman Empire started to disintegrate, being invaded in different areas by different varieties of barbarians. Edward Gibbon has written about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire in 6 very large volumes. You'll be relieved to hear that I'm not going to attempt a summary of this work. Suffice to say that it did decline and fall, leaving behind a legacy of buildings and roads, many of which survive in reasonable shape even today, of law and language, which remains a great influence in many parts of the world, and of literature important in the lives of many scholars. From about 400 AD, for several centuries, the European section of the Roman Empire entered the Dark Ages, where nothing much happened, or if it did, it was not recorded. Indeed, if it had not been for the efforts of religious academics like the Venerable Bede, much of our knowledge of what is called ancient history would have been lost. More or less coinciding with this, the last of the great religions sprang up. This was Islam, based on the teachings of Muhammad, born in about 570 AD. In the early 600s AD, he claimed to have received a series of messages called the Quran, which contains much material similar to the content of the New Testament. The Muslim religion, with its various sects, spread widely and rapidly in east and south of the Mediterranean and then to other countries, and there in most places, to a large extent, it has remained. Unfortunately, some extremists are able to place their own interpretation on some parts of the Quran and allying these to political causes. Much trouble has been and still is being caused. Back in England, which is the country from whose viewpoint I'll be tending to consider most of what I'll be saying from now onwards, it took until about the time of Alfred the Great in the 800s to start emerging from the Dark Ages. After that, and even taking into account the Norman conquest of 1066, I would venture to suggest that even until late as 1300 AD, England was not so very much advanced than it has been in Roman times 1,000 years previously. From about 1300 AD, various things started to happen. Some of the major ones were first the Renaissance in Italy, with a revival of interest in art and literature, and under Leonardo da Vinci in just about everything. Then the discovery of printing with movable type, invented by Gutenberg in Germany, and then taken to England by William Caxton. This meant that many more people became more liberated and interested in reading. Then Galileo in Italy had greatly improved the telescope and had sorted out the heavenly bodies in a way that was more or less correct, even though this was not generally agreed on for many years or even centuries. Sailing ships had greatly improved since Roman times. Ships had been reluctant to sail very far out of sight of land, but by the 1500s, Magellan, Drake and others had done their stuff. Guns had been invented but were not as yet very efficient. William Harvey had discovered the circulation of blood, but this made little impact on the average citizen. Likewise, Isaac Newton in England had made very important basic studies in physics. Finally, we come to William Shakespeare. No more may be said. However, notwithstanding all the above and no doubt many other developments, I submit that for the majority of people, life in England up until 1760 was still not all that very different from what it may have been in Roman times. There were few big towns in 1760, just London and a few ports like Plymouth and Bristol, and a few inland towns like York and Chester, all going back to Roman days. Most people lived in the country, with the men working in the fields and the women, apart from the usual domestic and family chores, spinning, weaving, making clothes, etc. If you wished to travel from point A to point B, you either walked or did something with a horse or other suitable animal, either rode it or organised it to pull a cart of some sort on mostly barely existing roads. Or if points A and B were reasonably near water, you might be able to go by boat. And certainly, as I've said, boats and navigational schools were more advanced than they had been in Roman times. Bigger and more efficient boats, but still totally reliant on wind power. If you wished to communicate between point A and point B, it had to be done by letter or note being sent out by one of the above means, except for the odd, not generally used methods such as lighting lanterns, lighting fires, carrier pigeons, etc. The quickest normal method of conveying an urgent message was by a rider on a galloping horse. And as a galloping horse can't do many kilometres before it needs a rest or to be replaced with a fresh horse, that method is not very efficient. Probably country life in England was generally quite healthy, but when illness or disease did strike, there was virtually no effective method of treatment, just numerous quack remedies, their reputations boosted at intervals by the ability of the human body frequently to recover by itself whatever appears to be wrong with it, regardless of what is or isn't done. Now, having got ourselves up to 1760, let us pause to meditate and gather strength to consider the nitty-gritty of the rest of this address, which is just coming up, by listening to a little more Beethoven. I'd like to think that many of the first hopefully good advances that happened after 1760 or thereabouts were attributable to Unitarians. I must say that this is not why I am Unitarian, I just mention it for interest. I like to think that one of the very first steps could have been the Unitarian minister Joseph Priestley's experiment, as we heard about in the children's story today. Joseph Priestley went on to do many experiments in electricity in conjunction with his friend, the remarkable American Benjamin Franklin, and then in chemistry, which barely existed as a science until his time. Then there was another of Priestley's friends, also one of the Lunar Men, who were a group of liberal intellectuals who all lived in the area of Birmingham and met monthly at the time of the full moon. This one was Josiah Wedgwood, who, by looking for good clay for his famous crockery, discovered fossils, and telling his friend and fellow lunar man Erasmus Darwin about his find, who in turn told his young grandson Charles Darwin about it, and the rest is history. The proclamation and subsequent gradual acceptance of the theory of evolution did not directly affect anybody much, but it did affect them indirectly by making them think. Then we have yet another of the Unitarian lunar men, James Watt, who didn't invent the steam engine, but greatly improved the one that had been invented. And suddenly there was an effective machine for converting coal into usable energy, and the Industrial Revolution had begun. James Watt and yet another Unitarian, Matthew Boulton, and no doubt hundreds of others in this field, had the engineering skills to utilise this energy to make in factories all sorts of things which had either never been made at all, or else had been made by women working slowly at home, or hammered out by the village blacksmith. By the late 1700s, there were many big towns in the north of England filled out with people who had previously been living in the country. By about 1830, George Stephenson had realised that a steam engine could be put on wheels and the resulting machine could be put on factory-made steel rails to run on, with a spot for the driver behind the engine, another little truck for the coal, and further wheeled trucks behind containing either passengers or freight. And the railway age had commenced with an incredible boom. Railway lines crisscrossed England in no time. England was the leading country with all these developments, but the rest of the developed world was not so very behind, in some cases, including Australia, only a decade or two. The development of railways in England meant that people who previously might never have travelled more than 10 or 20 miles at the most from home could suddenly see the world. Other advances in steam engines saw them in steam hammers, steam rollers and similar items, and in boats, initially tugboats and other coastal vessels, but soon moved on, and by about the mid-1880s, ocean-going vessels were almost all powered by steam, and travel from Australia to England, for instance, became dirtier, smellier and noisier than had been the case with sailing ships, but quicker, more reliable time-wise, and probably safer. Another major development which caused many people in Victoria, England, to feel that they were moving into a new world was the telegraph. Until the middle of the 19th century, means of communication had scarcely improved a bit since Roman times, because steam engines could go a bit faster and for a bit longer than galloping horses, but the improvement was not great. Suddenly, the invention of the telegraph enabled point A to communicate with point B, no matter how far away from each other they were, provided a continuous wire could join them. And it only took a couple of minutes, even if one point was in Australia and the other somewhere as far away as, say, England. And those minutes were consumed by the operator translating the message into Morse code at one end, and then another operator at the other end, translating the Morse code back into the original message. The actual coded message, covering the 15,000 miles or whatever it is, effectively instantaneously. In the field of medicine, nothing much had happened ever, but post-1960, the changes have been extraordinary, starting with Edward Jenner in the late 1700s with smallpox vaccine, a small drop of which scratched onto a person's skin, rendered that person immune from a disease which had previously been endemic, if not epidemic, was more likely to be fatal, and if not fatal, likely to leave disfiguring scars, which apparently most people had in those days. Then in about 1850, anaesthetics were invented with the result that surgery could develop in a civilized way. It was still marred by a high rate of infection, but Lord Lister revolutionized that by the introduction of sterile surgery in about 1865. In the meantime, diseases like typhoid and cholera had raged, especially in big cities and especially in the north of England, causing very high death rates until it was realised that their sanitary arrangements, which seemed disgustingly non-existent by our modern standards, were the cause. When these were attended to by the establishment of proper deep drainage, death rates from these causes fell dramatically. Scientific medicine advanced enormously in the latter part of the 19th century. Louis Pasteur of France established the bacterial basis of much disease. Virchow of Germany discovered the cellular basis of pathology and also of life itself. Mendel of Austria discovered genetics, leading to the determination that every cell in the body of any human contains 46 chromosomes, coils of which contribute to the nature of one or another of our inherited characteristics. The only exceptions were sperm cells in the case of males and ova cells in the case of females, each of which contain only 23 chromosomes, for obvious reasons. Much disease and death in the first part of that 19th century was due to shocking conditions in factories, overwork, underpay, overcrowding, child labour, etc. These were gradually improved or at least made less bad by various social reformers, including many Unitarians. In fact, especially as there had been no major wars since Napoleon in 1815, apart from the American Civil War in the early 1860s, there was a feeling amongst many optimistic individuals that the world was generally steadily improving towards some sort of El Dorado or state of perfection. This feeling was soon dissipated by the insane wholesale butchery of World War I. However, leaving aside that war, World War II, and the numerous relatively minor wars that have been and are still going on, almost unbelievable advances in our lives have occurred during the 20th century. The internal combustion engine came into use in about 1900, and soon motor cars running mainly on newly macadamised roads were starting to replace railway trains, steam trains, and steamships were being replaced by diesels. Aeroplanes were just dangerous curiosities up till World War I, but progressed rapidly during and after that, though did not come into general use until during and after World War II. Then they boomed, but perhaps COVID use, their use will decline. Man finally got to the moon and back in 1969. The telegraph was fairly rapidly largely replaced by the telephone from about 1900 onwards. The person's voice rather than the coded message went along the line. Wireless or radio came into fairly general use during the 1930s and was in most homes during World War II, as was television with a couple of decades or so after World War II. Then we have computers slowly evolving from years before World War II. But even after the end of that war, the most advanced computer was still as big as a small house. But within a few decades, it had evolved into a device small enough to fit into comfortably into one's pocket, yet able to do far more than the house-sized one had done. The world does face very considerable challenges adjusting to the computer age. Ernest Rutherford, born and bred in New Zealand, did the pioneer work on the structure of the atom, including the splitting of the atom in England in the early years of the 20th century. Progress was relatively slow until 1939, when Albert Einstein advised President Roosevelt that an atomic bomb could be built and it would be vastly more explosive than any ordinary bomb. A group of the top scientists got together and two bombs were dropped on Japan, which brought World War II to an end. Numerous countries now have them and have not been used in anger. Nuclear power started in about 1950 and has been widely used and still is by various countries, but 75 years later it is still unclear whether it is wise to use it more or not. Then the advances in medicine have been huge, impossible and inappropriate to do more than just mention a few in this address. The discovery of insulin in the 1920s to enable people with type 1 diabetes to lead reasonably normal lives with a bit of luck. Then the sensational saving of the life of a policeman in England dying from overwhelming streptococcal infection in 1941 with the new drug penicillin, which led to the antibiotic era which we have been living in ever since, still with penicillin sometimes, but many other antibiotics as well. Then various sorts of heart surgery, mainly post-World War II, which has enabled many people who would have died young from some sort of heart disease to enjoy good quality lives for several decades more. In a similar time frame, orthopaedic surgery may not have greatly improved longevity, but has greatly improved quality of life for many people. Treatment for many but not all forms of cancer seems to be improving fairly regularly. In fact, until COVID-19 appeared on the scene and possibly altered their views a bit, some people were suggesting that within the next generation or two, everybody could, barring accidents, live to 100 or with reasonable quality of life. Let us hope that the present generation of young people will be able to live at least to a normal, healthy old age and will want to. I have enough faith in the human spirit, call it God if you like, to believe that there is a pretty good chance that this will be so. However, the present generation will have to face and tackle numerous problems which were hardly recognisable at all when my generation were young adults just after the end of World War II. The first, and I believe the most serious one of all, is world overpopulation. The Western world has more or less got this under some sort of control. The third world most certainly has not. The second is pollution, particularly that of plastics and the world's oceans. The third is climate change, somewhat controversial at this stage, but surely bound to happen sooner rather than later if we continue to consume fossil fuel. The fourth would be huge changes in the workforce, as a vast and relatively unskilled type of workforce are rendered unnecessary by automation and by computers. And the list could go on. Now I hear you ask, what has all this got to do with religion? Well, the answer is quite a lot. In my opinion, most religions, including Christianity, probably especially including Christianity, exist in what might be called two layers. The first layer consists of a compilation of morals and ethics by which it hopes that its adherents will conduct their lives. In the case of Christianity, these would be extracted to some extent from the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments and a few other selected bits, but mostly Jesus' teaching and other selected bits of the New Testament. The second layer consists of dogma. All religions have their own specific dogma. In the case of Christianity, it can be basically summarized by the Apostles' Creed. Both these layers were effectively put together some 1500 years before that crucial date of round about 1760, and both layers served quite adequately up until that time, though some people were starting to have doubts about the second layer. Let us look at how the two layers weathered 1760 or thereabouts. The first layer continued right on through 1760 and is more or less as relevant now as it was 2,000 years ago. Now, as then, if you see a person lying by the roadside, you should stop and render appropriate assistance, even if that person is one with whom you would not normally be associating. It takes little imagination to extend it to being a group assisted by a group or a nation assisted by a nation. The prodigal son can be looked at similarly. The Marshall Plan after World War II is a wonderful example of that. It is a different story with the second layer, the dogma layer. As time went on from 1760, continued new scientific discoveries showed that more and more parts of the Apostle Creed could not possibly be literally true. I won't go into details, but it is easy to invent theories about conceptions and deaths and resurrection when you have no knowledge of chromosomes and cerebral neurons. Not so easy when you do have this knowledge. Similar arguments apply to God the Father Almighty. I will submit just one. What was the Father Almighty during World War I when millions of young men from one of his generations murdered each other, often at point-blank range, for no apparent reason? I do not believe that that sort of God can possibly exist. But perhaps there is a God in the form of the human spirit that exists in all of us to a greater or lesser extent. This is the spirit that can make any of us do things that cannot be credited to those cerebral neurons referred to above, not part of our protective instincts for ourselves or our families, not with the motivation of some sort of benefit for ourselves, families or friends, etc. That goes on anyway, but just that the extra, just to be helpful to others on a small or large scale. I believe that such a spirit can be enhanced by adherence to a liberal religion, one that promotes the first layer referred to above and probably incorporates ideas from other religions besides Christian and from other philosophies and maybe ideas that have not yet even been put into words but might be acceptable to all, and one that accepts the idea of an individual having a purely personal belief, even of the second layer if so desired. I believe that such a spirit can be enhanced on the world stage, and it might help to get the world out of its present challenging time. I realise, of course, that anything I say will have absolutely zero influence on any wider stage, and probably very little on any other. Nevertheless, the beliefs mentioned above are the main reasons why I am a Unitarian.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.